Welcome back to the Inspired Incompetence Podcast. It's educational. How's everybody doing?
I'm learning.
I feel like most of our education comes before we actually put on the recording.
That's true. We spoke ad nauseum over the finer points of whether or not you should follow the recipe. And I think we all came to the same agreement that you should.
No, that wasn't it.
Oh, really?
Oh.
It's that the recipe should be rewritten.
That's not the reality that I'm living in right now. Okay, so we are now in book 6 out of 6 of Tyrant's Grasp. Congratulations, everybody.
100%, hooray! We did it.
Holy fuck.
Wait, 5 out of 6.
Shit.
You've done it. Yeah. You guys finished all your shit in Yoli's Pond. You got yourselves some shiny new O-balls. And you are heading back to Last Wall, specifically the city of Volumis, where supposedly Aluna needs some help. So, another new thing, everybody's now level, 13?
18?
21?
24?
Set hike?
Help me out here. What is it? 16? Level 16, right?
16, yes.
Everybody's now level 16. That's pretty fucking cool. It's been a long time since anybody here has played a 16th level PC, and certainly not since we started the podcast.
Yeah, I was thinking about this earlier. I don't think I've ever played a 16th level character. Like, I've played characters more powerful than this with that Gestalt Mythic campaign we did a while back.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, like, the last time PCs got to this level was in Kingmaker, which I was running, so I wasn't playing a character.
That's true. So, who wants to talk about their level 16 characters?
I'll go first. No, I'll go. So, let's see. Velbar, level 16. Well, first off was, we'll go with the ability point increase. Everything I had was already at an even number, so I just kind of threw it into dex and hope we get to level 20 so I can pump it up again. Beyond that, I got 6th level spells, which I took a couple of ones that I think are going to be fun. One is called Overwhelming Presence. It's just a nice big burst effect that makes everything in the area like bow down to me as if I were a god. And what? Because of my archetype, it works on undead, so like I'm excited to see that in action. And the other was a spell called Euphoric Tranquility, which makes the target treat all creatures as dear friends and hates violence. And it is one of those, like, the initial effect is no save. So, like, if I use that on you, you just, everyone around you is your buddy, and you don't want to hurt anybody. And the creature only gets a saving throw if it gets attacked. And then it only can act normally for one round.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of descriptors here. It's a compulsion effect, it's a mind-affecting effect, and it's an emotion effect. Your archetype is specific to mind-affecting effects, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just wondering if that, since it's got all these other things going on, if that would make undead still immune to it.
I mean, aren't compulsion and emotion just different, like, subcategories of mind-affecting effects?
I don't think so, because mind affecting is like a, it's a descriptor. So like the emotion is also a descriptor. So they're kind of like riding on the compulsion subschool of the enchantment school spell. We can look into that later. It's probably fine. I don't know if undead are specifically immune to emotion effects anyway. That doesn't sound right, but there's a lot of stuff on that spell, so it just kind of had me thinking.
Yeah, I mean, my internal logic would be like they're immune to emotion effects because they're immune to mind affecting stuff. But they're not explicitly immune to emotion because everything that affects emotions falls under that mind affecting umbrella.
Well, as to that, it does kind of break that down in the undead traits. Because it says they are immune to mind-affecting effects, and then in parentheses it says charms, compulsions, morale effects, phantasms, and patterns. So it doesn't list emotion in there, but I'm looking at it now, and I don't see emotion being listed separately for things that it's immune to, so I'm guessing it's fine.
All right. Well,
it's probably fine.
Yeah, we can dig into it more later, but either way, I'm excited to have that even against living things that we might come across. I don't know how many of those we're going to have to deal with, but I imagine it's not going to be purely undead from here out.
Probably not.
But the last thing I got was a mesmerist trick at 16th level, so I took one called Free in Body. Once implanted, I can activate it as a free action like all tricks, and I can trigger it when the subject begins its turn grappled or under an effect that impedes movement, and I grant it freedom of movement for 1 minute.
What?
Yeah.
Damn.
After seeing what our genus got completely fucked up by that hand at the end of the Nessie fight and knowing how...
Yeah. And the black tentacles at the beginning of the fight.
Yeah. So, like, knowing how massive, like, grappling is as a crippling condition for spellcasters, that seemed like a prudent ability to snag.
Fair enough. All right, who wants to go next?
You know, actually, I will. My list isn't nearly as long as Matt.
I feel like most of them were not terribly long. I think I might have gotten the most of anyone because I got a trick. Like, most, for the most part, it was just spells for everyone this level.
Yeah, so my charisma was hanging at a 25, so bumped it up to a 26. So everything goes up for my charisma.
Wait, our genus's charisma is how high?
26.
Oh my God.
Can't you feel it?
Yeah, I guess I can.
So I then got access to 8th level spells. Now, this is a big one.
What? I didn't even know it went that... How high does it go? Does it go to 9?
9.
It goes to 9, yeah.
Oh my God.
So I was only able to pick one. But I think I picked a good one. I think I picked a really solid one. I picked Mind Blank, which is an effect over a 24-hour period. The effect is the subject is protected from all devices and spells that gather information about the target through divination magic, such as detect evil, locate creatures, scry, and see invisible, yada, yada, yada. This spell also grants a +8 resistance bonus on saving throws against all mind-affecting spells and effects. Mind Blank even foils Limited Wish, Miracle, and Wish spells when they are used in such a way as to gain information about the target. In the case of scrying that scans an area the creature is in, such as Arcane Eye, the spell works, but the creature simply isn't detected. Scrying attempts that are targeted specifically at the subject do not work at all. Now, on that, which this stacks with invisibility, so if Alex were to see True Sight,
it wouldn't work.
It wouldn't work. It wouldn't detect us. It wouldn't see us. And I have, guess how many castings of that per day? That's right, 4. So I have 4 castings of that spell, which means that at the beginning of the day, everybody's going to get mind blanked, and they increase those resistance bonuses indefinitely, although I...
Just against mind affecting, yeah.
Just against mind affecting effects, which I think is just huge.
Tom, I love that for us.
Yeah. When Tom was breaking that down between sessions, I was like, yeah, but it's probably got like... an expensive material component or something, because that sounds appropriate. And then I looked it up, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
Now, a couple things to note. First, if you have a Cloak of Resistance or some other resistance bonus to saves in general, the plus 8 doesn't stack. You're just taking the better of the two, which is probably the plus 8, but that means you're not getting a net plus 8 necessarily.
Right. At this level, we're probably getting plus 3, 4, 5, which is not nothing, but we're not getting the full 8.
And just fair warning, there are other senses that aren't counted as divination effects that can still see you.
Right.
Tremor sense, blind sense, scent, stuff like that.
It's not absolute that you guys can just kind of invisibly dance around the entire book undetected, but that is indeed a very, very good spell. And I also just want to give you guys fair warning that if you got your mind blank on and you're like, let's go invisible and scout through the place, like, you can no longer see each other either. Even if you put on see invisibility or something, if you want to scout quietly without speaking, you're gonna have to like do so not knowing where the other PCs are, unless you have some other means to communicate or designate where each other is.
I think we established this like last week. I don't know of a time where we've really actively gone out of our ways to like note where each other are during battle.
Yeah, but haven't we sort of hand waved it because of the fact that we could now that we can't, right?
No,
it's definitely come up before where just off the top of my head, I remember in book 2 when you guys were in Roslar's tomb fighting that undead that could like burrow underground and it like softened the earth into mud and everybody was like wading through it. At one point somebody was invisible. They were also like, they took a critical hit that said they couldn't speak, and like someone was like, I think like Joe was like, I need to heal this person, but we were like, you don't know where they are, they can't speak, you can't see them, and that was like a huge problem. So it's definitely come up before.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is it seems like this is an even bigger problem now. A lot of the times it isn't a problem because it's like, oh, we just use our words, or oh, we just, you know.
Well, it's still really not a big problem as I see it, because most of the time you're being invisible, you're in like a somewhat hostile situation. Mm-hmm. So
right.
It's definitely going to be a blessing more often for you.
Yeah.
Letting you know it's something to keep in mind.
What he's doing is he's being GM Axel, and he's like, but yeah, what about this little seed? Let me water it in your brain. This thing that's happened once in 3 years. That could happen again.
All right. I'll keep my shit to myself from now on.
I just know your game, sir.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
My only question for Tom is, that sounds totally sweet, but also, is there a offensive spell you could have taken? Isn't what's that one that you blow people apart with fire or whatever? Isn't that like a level 6 spell? Like what offensive shit is level 8?
There was a lot, honestly. There was a lot that could have done some crazy stuff, but with like,
I'm just waiting for you to be using mind blank. It's a blow up in our stupid face, and then us be like, Tom, use your strongest magic, use your nuke. It's like,
I feel like that's never really been Arginus's thing,
though. Right. Definitely hasn't.
Right.
I also only have like 4 castings of this, so like
it's interesting. I'm loving the path you took. I'm just excited for what that means. You know what the implications are.
Don't let basic Joe bring you down, Tom. You picked a great spell.
I'm not saying he didn't.
Everybody seems all he to can be think of is magic go burr. Of this. Then like, I was so confident about this. I was so happy.
No, it's good. You picked a very good spell.
Yes.
Honestly, I think you're going to save lives with that spell.
Probably. I said this between sessions, but my God, book 6 is going to, it's going to suck. It is, I think, the deadliest book I have ever prepped, ever.
You didn't say that between sessions. and I don't like that.
Yeah, I don't remember that part.
All right, well, saying it now. Did Arginus have anything else? I think he got something from his hair.
I did. I got the final tower. What was it? Tower of Wisdom?
Yep.
Tower of Wisdom. I don't know that off the top of my head, but it does some cool effects.
Plus one caster level.
Plus one caster level. That's right. That was actually big. I forgot about that.
There's a reason it's the last one you get.
That's actually huge.
Yeah. Speaking of hair, like, I was just thinking the other day, like, I'm not sure which would be worse for this specific thing in my mind, but, like, if Arginus used that Harrower ability when casting Disintegrate, and if he got three strength cards and one of them was Chaotic Good, that's a +4 bonus to the damage per die rolled.
Yeah.
And Disintegrate would be 32d6.
Yep. So that's like +120 damage right there.
Yeah.
God.
I was like, there's only one Chaotic Good strength card.
Yeah.
But even still, I had that thought. I was like, oh my God, that would just be, that would be insane.
Yeah.
But honestly, having three wisdom cards and one of them be Chaotic Good wisdom, that's +4 to your caster level. That's right. +8d6 on top of your 16d6 for Disintegrate.
Right, right, right. Yeah, the big thing that the current thing that I'm like thinking about right now is I gotta make sure that these spells hit, like, because I feel like we're going into territory where my spells are either gonna be in or they're gonna be out.
Yeah,
yeah, that's kind of what guided me to taking Mind Blink, like. It's an 8th level spell, and honestly, wasting those slots onto something that's might...
You just know you never have to worry about it. Right. Doesn't work.
Yeah, the fact that it's just 24-hour duration is, like, that makes it, like, even better still, because you literally just, you cast it, and you know you don't need to worry about it until the next day when you prepare your spells, or you just get them back.
He didn't pick a spell as much as he picked an effect.
He picked a lifestyle.
This, by the way, is not going to be a scram situation. Like, I am, like, this is a definitive.
I wake up in the morning, I cast this on everybody.
I'm casting it every single day on everyone. Like, that's flat out it.
Wake up in the morning, I cast Mind Blink. All right, who wants to go next?
I'll go next.
Okay.
Well, as is tradition, I rolled like garbage on my hit dice. I think I rolled another 2. So I'm level 16 with 121 health.
Nice.
It's kind of terrible.
That's not
pretty
great.
Bad.
It's pretty bad. Yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, doing the math.
I'm chilling with the full spellcasters. For my ability point, I put it in intellect, which bumped up from a 27 to a 28. Now giving Uhtred a +9 modifier. And anytime my intellect modifier goes up, that's pretty big because it's factored in basically everything Uhtred does or has. And then for level 16, the Magus gets Counter-Strike. Whenever an enemy within reach of me successfully casts a spell defensively, that enemy provokes an attack of opportunity from me after the spell is completed, and the attack of opportunity cannot disrupt the spell. But basically, if you're a spellcaster standing next to Uhtred, no matter what you do, he's going to get the swing on you.
That's sweet.
That's pretty good.
Yep. And that was just
especially
like
with all the critting. I mean, aren't there spell cards that do some pretty interesting things potentially?
Uhtred basically is a human slot machine where I just want pulls.
How about spells?
So for spells, I got 6 level spells. So I took 2 6 level spells.
Smart.
Yep. The first one, True Seeing. I think at this point, everyone kind of knows what that's all about. And then for my second one, I took Shield of the Dawnflower Greater. You create a disc of sunlight on one arm. Any creature that strikes you with a melee attack deals normal damage, but it also takes 1d6 points of damage plus 1 point per caster level. Half of this damage is fire, half of this damage is holy. an undead creature or a creature particularly vulnerable to light that hits you instead takes 2d6 points of damage plus 1 point per caster level. Doesn't work on creatures with reach weapons, and the shield provides illumination equivalent to a daylight spell, and I can only have one instance of the spell effect at a time.
That's pretty crazy, like, especially since it doubles as a daylight spell.
Yeah.
Now, the duration is only one round per level, so it's not like you're going to throw that on and, yeah, then you're good through the whole dungeon or anything, but that's a pretty solid spell.
And it also felt very thematically on point for Uhtred. He's just got fucking light coming out his ass now. His sword, his cape.
His whole brand.
Yeah, really. We're merchandising now, though.
All right, who wants to go last?
I'll go last. One question I had, what was the ability that potentially maximized my healing spells? Remember last week we were talking about...
Your obols now, that got flipped?
Yeah, yeah. How did that work exactly?
Any sources of healing that you take from positive energy are maximized. So any die that gets rolled, you treat it as if it was the highest die result.
So that is especially insane for me because I can cast the 6th level cleric spells when I channel the Hierophant.
Yes.
And I have that trance of 3 that makes it so that even if I'm not the Hierophant, I can tap into the healing of the Hierophant, which mm-hmm. is the mass cure moderate at this level. So that would be 2d8 plus 16. Which would be 16 plus 16, which would just be 32, if my math is right.
I don't think you get that while doing Trance of 3.
Yeah.
What?
I was going to say, because Trance of 3 only gives you access to, like, channel.
It gives you access to channel and the cure spells, but not the extra spell slots or spells per day.
Oh,
so you just don't
right.
have 5th and 6th level spell slots while doing Trance of 3.
Okay, well, that sucks, but it is sweet that I get all the other stuff maximized from the Hierophant.
Yes.
And you could just flip your order, like, you reverse what you were trying to do and channel the champion.
Right. Right.
Yes.
So you get all the cool healing, and you still truck domes.
Yes. Right. But that would involve me channeling the Hierophant, which we'll have to see.
I mean, you've done it the last couple days in a row.
Like, can we rewind the tape to... Guys, this is the most deadly book I've ever prepped. Ever.
Who said that?
You said it. I want Joe to actually hear it.
Okay, so we may or may not see more Hierophant, is all I'm saying. Because the 6th level, another one is that heal spell. Which mm-hmm. is apparently yeah. insane. I just heal... 10
hit points
HP.
Per caster level. Yeah.
So, look out for that. And then the rest of it was pretty tame. I actually max rolled my hit die, so in your face, Nick.
Wow, and, good for you.
My lay on hands, I get an extra one, and now it's 66, which is insane.
So it's always 36 because of the obols.
The obol is really, like, my biggest buff, I would say. Like, 6-level spells... Some cool stuff, you know, just generally stronger, but like those obols are just an absolute game changer for the healing side of Thalias.
Now, does Thalias still have that Ring of Curing?
I don't know. Ring of Curing, what is that?
It was a ring that you got at some point, I'm sure at Matt's direction, that increases the maximum amount based on caster level of a spell that you a cure spell that you cast by 2. So if you cast Cure Light Wounds, instead of 1d8 plus 5, it'd be 1d8 plus 7.
Whoa. whoa. Yeah, and I do have it. Matt, you're a genius.
It includes the heal spell, which would instead cure a maximum of 170 at caster level 17th, instead of 150 capping.
This healing stuff is crazy.
I mean, with Trance of 3, you still get the benefits of, like, Cure Light, Cure Moderate, and Cure...
Serious?
Critical? I can never keep those last two straight in my head. I mean, yeah, with Trance of 3, you would still get the Ring of Curing boost from those. But yeah, getting that extra 10 for heal at level 16, that's pretty big.
Especially with the fact that heal can be used as a touch attack that just like deals 170 damage to an undead, or, you know, if they pass their will save, they only take 85.
Oh yeah, right. That too.
Although the Ring of Curing does specify it's
for healing. Okay, so instead of taking 150 damage, they only take 75.
Yes.
Yeah, but before we move on, it has come to my attention that we never went over the shopping that we did on our international shopping spree. I know we've made use of some of the items, like the cauldron that Arginus got and Uhtred's otherworldly kimono, but I figure between that and the little bit of cash we had to shop with after last session, it might be good to go over some important bits of new equipment that we might have and be making use of that the audience isn't aware of.
All right, sure.
You want to start us off?
I mean, I feel like I didn't really have much for that shopping trip because, you know, brand new character and all that. Like, I think the only thing I bought at that was like I upgraded my cloak and like my amulet of natural armor or something. But with the selling off the dragon horde and the money we got from that, I thought about it and I kept going back and forth. But in the end, I went with something that Alex actually suggested, and that is a broom of flying.
Yes.
Nice.
I was initially going to go with the slightly cheaper boots or winged boots that like Arginus uses. It's like 3 times per day. You get 5 minutes worth of flight. But after Alex kind of like turning me onto this item, the broom of flying, like it's a slower flight. It's basically the equivalent of like overland flight versus the fly spell. But it's just, I have hours worth of duration on this thing and I have a fly speed now, which has been, in the short time that Valbar has been with the party, has been his biggest liability, is his inability to fly.
Sweet.
Yeah. With whatever money I have left, or if anyone has money left over, sinking cash into diamond dust is not a bad idea, because we have several spells that require that, and I have a feeling they may be more heavily in use coming soon.
Speaking of diamonds, I believe you guys got a 5,000 gold diamond from the Dragon Horde?
Yes, that did not get sold, because that happens to be the exact requirement for a Raise Dead spell.
Is that the only diamond worth 5,000 gold that you guys have?
I believe so right now. That's usually something that we would go to find when we need to cast it, not something we usually have preemptively. But
right.
Since we found one, it seems like a good thing to have on hand.
I'm just saying, a diamond worth 5,000 gold can be turned into 5,000 gold worth of diamond dust.
Yeah, no, I'd rather keep the diamond and just buy more diamond dust, personally.
Right, but what I'm saying is, you want to buy more diamond dust, if enough gold is being put up for it, maybe just buy another diamond worth 5,000 gold that you can turn into diamond dust later.
What if we took the diamond dust and put it, you know, glued it together to make a diamond?
squeezed it real hard? Who knows what'll happen? It's worth a shot.
So I know we've discussed this before, but my 3 chains, my...
your amulets?
I forget what they're called.
Your talismans?
Talismans. Those things are so insane now that I get max healing on my dice rolls.
Oh my god, yeah.
Balls. Like, I had purchased that before, but like that is... It's like the purchase of a lifetime now. I look like a fucking genius. not 4d8, it's 32 plus 7 or whatever,
yeah, so,
it is.
Yeah, so 39, yeah. Guaranteed.
I have like 2 hit point bars, plus I have healing spells.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Not to taunt Alex or anything, not to give him any... Oh, I'll have to hit him twice as hard. Well, you can't heal if you're cut in half.
So it's doubly better for that. It's triply better for you specifically, because you're a reanimated medium. So like if Uhtred was wearing those and I just hit Uhtred hard enough to just kill him, they wouldn't activate. But you don't truly die until an entire round has passed. So if I hit you like ridiculously hard and brought you down to like negative 50 hit points, like just as a random example, those amulets would still activate and bring you back.
Like, as an example, if, you know, currently, if I'm reading this right, Thalias has 149 hit points.
Yeah.
Say you had taken a little bit of a hit, but you weren't at, you know, you weren't below half yet to trigger the thing. Say you were at 100 hit points, and Alex hits you with a harm spell, which is the opposite of heal. Just, and you fail your save, just bam, there's 150 damage. Normally that would just kill you because it would have dropped you to like negative 50 health. But because you're a reanimated medium, you don't die immediately. You're there for a round, which gives those three talismans enough time to activate and bring you back to consciousness before what you should have died from.
Yep. Now, harm specifically, it specifically says it can't kill you. It leaves you at one hit point, but that example still stands.
Yeah, there are things that do that. That was just the first thing that popped into my head. That was like guaranteed amount of damage.
Right.
I feel like one of those inflatable things where you kick it and then it comes back up.
And it's like, I was thinking more wobble than that.
Thalias wobbles, but he won't fall down.
You feel like Wobbuffet to me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Pretty much. Any other purchases that anyone wants to go over?
You know, this is going to be... This isn't a purchase, and this is like a random thought, but with time passes, but have we ever celebrated an in-game birthday? Like, I don't think I've ever had a birthday in a Dungeons & Dragons Pathfinder game.
Yeah, I feel like...
Just a random thought.
Yeah, in Skull and Shackles, we probably would have just because of the amount of time that passed in between events there.
I think it was a little over 10 months total.
Yeah.
But like Skull and Shackles.
In this, it's been, what, 2 months? Two? Three, maybe? Since we died the first time?
It's been more than that. I'd say 5 months, probably.
Really?
Worst 5 months of my life.
Yeah, because I mean, I think book four itself was about a month.
Felt like a year.
Right, but I feel like books 1 through 3 were only like a month. Like, I feel like the longest single stretch of time we had there was like the 6 days it took us to travel from Roslar's Coffer to Vigil, which was like 6 days.
Well, we were like in Vigil for
3 days,
10?
For a while. I'd say probably 3 months then.
Either way, this is a very condensed story on the scale of like APs.
Utrid, how much eye ointment did you buy with your Dragon Horde gold?
Eye ointment?
The material component for true seeing.
Oh, like, I don't know. Lots of
a barrel?
Okay.
The I don't know. Whatever number Joe would worth? Say would... Yeah, Cheryl's worth.
It's 250 gold per casting, so just just get that figured out.
Yeah, I'll buy like 2K of that.
All right.
Okay, so like 8 castings of it. That's a good reserve to have.
Yep. All right, so with that, let's dive into book 6 with a flashback.
Ooh.
A breeze sails through the vast open plains of Lastwall, sending ripples through the tall grass and a mid-spring chill over a small group of travelers. Several of the group pull their traveling cloaks tighter, shrinking under the cold air. It's not a stretch of any kind to take this as a group of refugees, adults and children alike, trudging through the soft, muddy field, many empty-handed, and those who have packs carry only what they need. Most of them are human, but a family of halflings can be seen, as well as a couple dwarves and half-orcs. No one speaks. We can hear only the chorus of wet, squishy footsteps, or the occasional whimper of a child. The monotony is broken by the hard thud of galloping hooves. The group stops and turns around fearfully. Some of the children begin crying. We turn with them, and after a moment, recognize a Lastwall warhorse carrying a semi-armored knight of Ozum, approaching the refugees with haste. A spray of mud follows the mounted knight, with each gallop kicking up the loose, wet ground beneath it. Upon spotting the flag of Lastwall, the group relaxes. Parents begin calming their children. The warhorse slows to a trot as it reaches the traveling group. The knight rides with no helmet, and the rest of his armor appears to have been donned hastily, missing several important components. He surveys the group tiredly as his horse snorts and pants, as if it had been ridden too hard for too long. The refugees likewise send appraising looks at this bedraggled knight and his exhausted horse. The knight breaks the silence. Heading to Hammerrock. The group looks around at each other before nodding yes at the question. The knight looks once more upon the mud-caked boots, filthy cloaks, and fatigued faces of the group. Where are you coming from? Three Pines Ford? Some more exchanged looks. Then a handsome, if worn through, halfling steps forward. We may as well have, sir. We're from... well, most of us are from a village on the eastern edge of the Fangwood. When the dead came, we first headed southeast to Volumus, but half a day later we were cut off by roving zombies. We decided to head northeast to Dortrat Ranch instead. We figured maybe they had caravans set up there. But a couple days later, we were cut off again by skirmishes that we wanted nothing to do with, and resigned ourselves to seeking shelter at Hammerrock to the northwest. The knight nods. Well, you're in luck. Hammerrock has been organizing armed caravans to Caliphus. It's where my squadron was ordered to fall back to if we lost too many. Well, it's where I'm falling back to, anyway. A grave silence falls over the two parties as they reflect on the full gravity of it all. Something to be done sparingly while in danger, while your mind must remain sharp. Come on, then. You may call me Sir Mervin. I'll escort you the rest of the way. We're only a few hours out from Hammerrock from here. Time passes, and the large castle known as Hammerrock is now visible in the distance, conjuring the first whispers of hope from the travelers in a long time. Sir Mervin pats his warhorse's back as he walks beside it. Not long now. After the initial excitement slips away, and the group is silent again, the handsome halfling glances up at the knight. Sir Mervin, apologies, but I need to ask you, what news have you of Lastwall? You said that they were moving people from Hammerrock to Caliphus. In Ustalav. Sir Mervin purses his lips in discomfort before answering. That's because there's nowhere safe in Lastwall anymore. And you can stop calling it that. Lastwall is fallen. You march through the Gravelands now. A child begins crying. One of the human refugees looks at the knight, as if struck. Nonsense. My family were all born in Lastwall. We swore oaths of loyalty to support the Crusade and its ideals. He wrenches his sleeve up and brandishes his open palm at Sir Mervin, showing a tattoo, glowing ever so slightly, of a steel shield. You have one to match, sir, plus your second oath of protection, marked on your other hand. This is Lastwall, to our last breath. You will find your shield mark no more binding today than a simple drawing on paper. The refugee looks doubly affronted. He takes a sharp inhale for a retort, but Sir Mervin cuts him off. But that makes the oaths that conjured it even more important. It is when we stand to lose the least for abandoning our vows that they become the most important. I feel your pain. Truly, I do. But we mustn't hold a higher reverence for a nation than we do the people who made it. Lastwall exists now only in the chronicles of its survivors. It is no longer a place. It is me. It is you. We must protect it, and not waste words or tears on old borders on a map. Nearly every refugee was looking at him by the time he finished talking. Silence followed, cut through only by the constant squish of muddy marching. The knight aims his glassy eyes forward, perhaps trying to convince himself the very thing he just said. The halfling gives him a firm nod. Well said, sir. The human refugee nods in somber agreement. Then, once we arrive at Caliphus, then what? Sir Mervin's response is cut off as his horse lets out a whinny, bucking its head in distress. He pulls it closer to him for comfort while looking around, and his eyes grow wide as he spots the danger to the southeast, in the direction they came. A dozen tall figures bound toward them. Still about a quarter mile back, they seem to be humanoid, a dozen feet tall, and wrapped in bandages. The refugees spot them a moment later, a breath of dread spreading through the tired masses. As panic begins to swell, Sir Mervin moves to the front of the group. We can make it! Refuge is within our grasp. We need only reach out and claim it. Over the sobs of fear and grunts of exhaustion, the knight continues to marshal the dead, tired group with all the haste they can conjure. That's it! You didn't make it this far to be cut down 1,000 feet from safety! But the mummified giants were advancing frighteningly fast. Come on, push! Put everything you have left into it! You are last wall, to your last breath! One of the children trips. A panting middle-aged man stops to help the child up, but the young one is too frightened to get back up, and the man is too weak to help more. Sir Mervyn doubles back and heaves the child onto his shoulders. You can feel his stamina plummet as he makes his way back to the front while carrying a terrified kid with him, and then another child trips. Sir Mervyn looks back at the giants, now close enough to be identified as Cyclopes, each with one bulging, milky white eye glaring them down from behind the bandages. In that moment, he makes his decision and places the child on his horse, scoops up the second one, and sets him on the same saddle, and grabs a third for good measure before giving his steed a sharp slap with the flat of his sword, sending the children galloping toward Hammerrock. The knight comes to a halt, letting the refugees stumble past him towards safety. Don't stop! You can make it! He turns around, drawing his dagger in his offhand, and stands at the ready, wielding two blades as the Goldakos lumber toward him. He lets out a mighty battle cry, dirty sweat coating his face, his bloodshot eyes bulging with the spirit of his final moments. The ground begins to shake as the giant strides grow closer until we can hear their laborious grunting. They close the last of the distance, reaching out to Sir Mervyn, and as he swings his longsword, we cut to the group of refugees. From their vantage point, we can see that the horse carrying three terrified children has reached the gates of Hammerrock, and bells begin to clang as the defenders behind the walls receive them and behold the approaching civilians and the danger beyond. The refugees are nearly there, but they're practically limping, the pace slowed to a crawl with no strength left. We can see archers on the walls readying their arrows. We look southeast with them, past the refugees, and behold the Goldakos advancing once more. Sir Mervyn is nowhere to be seen. As one, they pull back their bowstrings and fire. Volley after volley, they pepper the giants, who slow at the attack, but they do not stop. The strongest of the refugees has reached the threshold and collapsed behind Hammerrock's walls, but the weakest have started to collapse outside of the fort's protections, where the archers' pestering arrows won't be able to save them. An outfit of knights race out past the walls, led by a heavily armored half-orc. They try helping up the fallen refugees, but there's no time. The knights draw their swords and shields and put themselves in front of the civilians just as the giants close the gap. The half-orc bellows a prayer to Iamide, and his soldiers glow a radiant red as divine magic fortifies their nerve. For several harrowing moments, we witness the knights lean on defense, keeping the giants at bay with admirable shield work. But as we watch, their eventual doom is clear. Those still behind the walls know they must close the gates and watch their brethren perish, or risk the safety of everyone remaining in Hammerrock. With a chilling crunch, a shield is sent flying through the air, dented beyond use. As it lands, though, a gut-punching roar interrupts the brawl, and the defenders and raiders are cloaked in shadow as an enormous creature flies overhead. The soldiers look up and cheer. It's Temi Azrael! Temi Azrael is back! The mummified Cyclopes look up as well and growl at the enormous bronze dragon as it descends upon them, crackling with electricity. With the giants thoroughly occupied, the soldiers return their efforts to carrying and dragging the collapsed refugees into the safety of Hammerrock, while the half-orc supports Temi Azrael. And within a minute, half-orc and dragon have taken apart the last of the giants in a brutal display of strength and spell. 10 minutes later, and the last of the refugees, conscious or otherwise, have been brought into the barracks, resting on beds and cots. The muffled sound of celebration can be heard outside, with occasional shouts of the name Temi Azrael leaping over the din. In the dim, torchlit barracks, two medics busy themselves over the dozens of patients.
This one must have marched for 2 full days on
2 sprained ankles. He's one of the lucky ones. These two have internal bleeding, and about half the patients I've looked at are in advanced stages of dehydration. It's a miracle they made it as far as our front gate. Let's thank the Dawnflower for keeping them moving until the very end. Some of them will be worse for wear, but when we're done, I think they'll all have survived this ordeal. Let's get to work. A crumpled thump interrupts the medics as a civilian's pack tumbles onto the floor from atop their cot. Let's have Seyfried inventory their belongings, too, sooner than later, before everyone gets too carried away with the Temiazril reception. One of the medics bends over to pick up the fallen pack, but stops, stooped over. What's this? He strains back up, holding what looks like a large splinter of wood, about the length of an outstretched palm, but the splinter is glowing with a flickering green light. Fell out of their bag, I think. The other medic walks over to look, and in the time it took for them to approach, the green light has gotten brighter, and we can see both their faces flickering in the green glow. In no time, the light has eclipsed the torches and gotten so bright, the medics start to squint and shield their eyes. Should we go get Captain Trant? And then we cut away. We're about 1,000 feet outside Hammerrock, watching the fort from a distance. In the foreground, we can see the crumpled body of Sir Mervyn, still partially armored, dead in the dirt, following his heroic sacrifice that got the refugees to safety. In the distance, the sky ignites, and Hammerrock is consumed, utterly and completely, without warning, by the radiant fire. A moment later, a blast of air surges past us, taking Sir Mervyn out of sight with it. Green-tinted dust is carried into the air until nothing is visible beyond the cloud. Swirls of dirt and sunlight come in brief glimpses as destruction incarnate blows past us and around us. And then, for a brief moment, the chance pockets of empty space in between the dust, filled with sunlight, form the title screen. Book 6, Midwives to Death. And the chaos begins to simmer. The dust cloud settles, and when we can again see, we've changed locations. Hammerrock, or whatever may remain, is nowhere in sight. Instead, a large port city can be seen to the southeast, and just outside of the city, a small group appears at the end of a greater teleport as Arginus, Uhtred, Thalias, and Valbar arrive back in Lastwall for the first time in nearly 2 months. So, Arginus, tell us about your teleport spell. Because you were told to teleport the group to Volumus.
Yeah, greater teleport.
Yep.
So I don't think you can teleport to a kitchen with this, because even with greater teleport, you need not have seen the destination, but in that case you must have at least a reliable description of the place to which you are teleporting.
I mean, we could describe a kitchen.
If you attempt to teleport with insufficient information or with misleading information, you disappear and simply reappear in your original location. I don't think describing generic kitchen will suffice. Arginus can certainly teleport to Volumus. If, you know, just even if you want to say that, you know, you've never been to Volumus, you don't even know what it looks like, I'd say just like getting out a map of Lastwall and seeing where Volumus is on that map is sufficient for greater teleport. Speaking of maps, I see somebody pinging Volumus on our Lastwall map, everybody. So Arginus teleports the group to Volumus. You find yourselves about a bow shot outside of the city. The Volumus outskirts are a mess of churned earth, scorched heaps where corpse pyres have run their course, and broken bones.
Sounds welcoming.
Clearly, there is active fighting, active raids being sent to Volumus, which the city has been, up to now, successfully turning away and keeping the city defended. But yeah, it is clear that you are in an active war zone right now. And almost immediately after you appear, you hear a You hear a horn sounding from behind the wall, and you hear very distant sound of men shouting. Gate opens up, and several armored knights ride out to meet you. They don't look like they're like charging to, you know, go attack you, but they are certainly like they have their weapons like in hand because they don't know what to expect. They ride up to you and they say, "You there? Who are you? Where did you come from?"
Velbar turns his stare on him and cocks his head, but remains silent, letting someone else actually answer.
I am Uhtred Bebenbur. We have just come from Njolispan, Zapato.
The knights, they exchange looks. I say, "Uhtred Bebenbur. Oh, well, you better come with us." And they, like, immediately about face and lead you guys through the city gates to Volumus.
I look over at Arginus and my face says, "I can't believe you didn't say and the Phrasma Four."
I was hoping so it would catch on. I was hoping he would actually say it.
Arginus has a great sense of what your face is saying. All right, so yeah, you guys are escorted into the city. And it's not very crowded. It looks like about half of the occupants within the walls are military. The other half are refugees or, you know, just maybe citizens of Volumus. But most people look very bedraggled, like they don't belong. But yeah, it does not look like a fully populated city. You get the feeling that the people who once lived in Volumus are long gone, and the people currently in the city are the military, whose job it is to ferry refugees out of the country, and whatever refugees happen to be there who haven't been ferried out yet. But as you guys are brought through the streets, eventually you see like a couple soldiers who are walking by. They stop and they notice you guys and they're just like staring at you. And then that kind of grabs the attention of a couple other soldiers who like look like, what are those guys staring at? And they see you and they stop and they stare. And then this kind of just starts to spread. And like within the course of like a city block, you're leading this trail of silence through the city. As everybody stops to stare at you. Maybe by now, a lot of people staring don't know why they're staring at you. They just know that you have attracted this rapt attention. But certainly, most of the people staring at you, they seem to know who you are, and they seem like struck that they're looking at you. But eventually, you are brought to looks like it used to be some sort of storefront. And they walk you inside, and you see a large table taking up the center of what used to be this floor space in this shop that has this enormous map of Lastwall draped across it. All these other smaller maps spread out, pins poking through different maps. Not sure exactly what they mean, but probably just some sort of denoting troops or enemies or movements, and just kind of doubled over, like hands on the table and like hunched over this map, Uhtred and Thalias and Arginus would recognize Ilunavar Vados.
Ah, yes.
Just real quick too, I imagine while we were like going through the streets, I know it was like all of us, I think, that were probably, well, the three, I'm sure Velbar was mostly like a sideshow because he's not a known entity here, but I imagine the three of them. I don't know,
how many times do you see a gnome riding a broom going down the road?
Right? but I imagine the effect is bolstered by the fact that we are all probably like clean and Uhtred is literally like glimmering in a cloak of light.
Oh yeah, does draw a lot of eyeballs, doesn't it?
It probably was a big help to get the staring started. Everyone going like, What gaudy ass motherfucker thinks they're gonna walk through? Oh,
it has a very different effect when you've been going through like Gallows Spire or bad shit. Then you get back to civilian, and you're like, what a fucking douchebag.
But yeah, very good point. I always like to keep those visuals in mind. But yeah, you're like brought to Aeluna. Like these soldiers, like they're just like, you need to see Aeluna. And once you're like standing right before her, one of the soldiers says, "High Priestess, there's someone here that you should see." She straightens up and she looks at you guys, and Uhtred, she's like looking right at you, but there's this distance to her gaze, and you see a woman fatigued. And she's looking at you, but like you can tell she's just like she's not taking in that she's looking at you.
Well, Uhtred's seen that look before. He's worn that look before.
Yeah. She just says, "Yes, what is it?"
"Well, it's good to see you, Aeluna."
"Who?" And she like shakes her head slightly in confusion, and then you just see this sharpness return to her eyes, and she's like looking at you for the first time, and then her eyes get glassy, and then her lip quivers, and then tears just flow down her face, and just this unbridled emotion that she must have been holding in for weeks just to make sure she could do her job. She just lets go, and she takes a couple steps toward Uhtred, and she takes her hands and she just like holds like both sides of your face. She's just like looking at you. "Uhtred."
"Aeluna, it's me."
Evni told me that she spoke to you, but I didn't pay her any mind. There was so much more to worry about. I honestly didn't take her seriously. I'm so glad that you're alive." And then she like looks at the rest of you all. And she's, "And Randolph and Arginus," and she gets to Valbar. She kind of sways, as I'm sure Valbar affixes his gaze onto her.
"Oh yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I remember you."
"That is because you have not met me, Priestess. My name is Valbar Fiddlestitch."
"I'm honored to make your acquaintance, Valbar. If you are an ally of Uhtred's, then I'm glad to see you."
One other thing you should know, Aeluna.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
That is Randolph's body, but that's no longer Randolph. That is Thalias Baker.
It's complicated.
Wasn't Thalias the gooey fellow that Randolph had with him before?
The one and the same.
It's complicated.
The gooey fellow.
I'll take your word for it. I've barely slept since getting the news from Absalom.
Quite all right. I imagine even if you had the time to sleep, you'd probably still get very little.
Indeed.
"What news from Absalom do you speak of, my lady?"
The Whispering Tyrant himself appeared at the edge of the Cairnlands, northeast of the city, only days ago, with thousands of undead troops. Our intelligence says that his forces have been clearing a large area amid the ruins and siege castles, and apparently he's just simply waited since then. Seems to me he's awaiting reinforcements before attacking Absalom in earnest. And then she kind of like straightens up with a start, and I think I've deduced where they're coming from. And she turns and she sweeps aside some scattered papers and uncovers the eastern section of her large last wall map and points at a hilly region with only a few red flagged pins. This was Hammerrock. It's a sizable castle intended to watch over the Path River, and its commander, Captain Somar Trant, volunteered to continue defending it to help refugees escape toward Caliphus. A little over a week ago, the sky flared with the unmistakable light of the radiant fire, and our divinations indicated Hammer Rock was the target. Now, let's be clear. Hammer Rock was hardly a strategic threat to the Whispering Tyrant, as it was. And after his initial tests in Roslar's coffer, he's reserved the radiant fire for serious targets. Something he particularly feared or wanted must have been there. And then, a few days later, he suddenly emerged outside Absalom with part of an army in tow. It can't be a coincidence. Now, the rest of Avastan is in no position to send me the forces necessary to find out why the Whispering Tyrant was so interested in Hammer Rock. But that didn't stop me from sending a team of my best remaining agents to learn more. We lost contact with them. They might be captured. They're trapped in a warded area, dead or worse. Absalom's already struggling to muster its defenses. But whatever's happening beneath Hammer Rock, you and any of my surviving team in the field are the only ones in a position to act on it. You've already been through so much. I'm sorry I couldn't get a nicer homecoming for you, but...
Trust me, one was not expected. Velma, do I remember correctly? You were in Hammer Rock, right, when the Radiant Fire went off?
Aluna's head snaps towards Valbar.
Valbar just cocks his head to the side. That is correct.
Interesting.
By chance, is there anything you could remember that might have been... I understand how this is going to sound, but unusual or out of place for whatever the new norm was while you were there?
Other than the influx of refugees, of which I counted myself amongst, I do not believe so. Not to my knowledge, at least.
You don't think, Aluna, that he simply was using the high density of people there to just make more undead?
It's not impossible, Uhtred, but I dare say he did not need to use the Radiant Fire for that.
And there are surely better fields for him to reap such a harvest. Either way, it sounds like there is a mystery at Hammer Rock that may provide us some boon going forward. Shall we investigate? Or should we take this straight to Absalom and take our chances?
There's certainly a part of me that says we should just go straight to Absalom. But before we do anything, Elena, I think we should maybe catch you up to speed on what we've been up to.
Of course. She kind of waves some guards over and she says, please, if you don't mind bringing us some food and water, I could use a break anyway.
Ooh, we should treat Aluna to some delicacies of Yolispan.
Yes.
They've got this stuff called salsa. You're not going to believe it.
Out in front, I just pull out the cauldron.
All right. Okay. everybody take a step back here. And, boosh.
A-boom.
A-boom.
Can you, like, pick the style of cuisine? Or is it limited to, like, a set meal that it always produces?
No, it's very nondescript with this.
It says, nourishing, simple fare, sufficient to feed up to 36 people for a day upon command.
36 people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very specific, huh?
It's and just also, so many goddamn people. Imagine going to a restaurant and ordering 12. For 36 people.
What do we look like? Buca de Peppas?
Oh, Jesus.
Because also, Tom, if you could do it in the cuisine of Zapotl.
I would hope I could. Like,
if you could, I'm just saying that's a good way to, if you want Uhtred to say he's part of the Phrasma Four.
Yeah.
You get a lot out of him with salsa
like,
bribes.
Come on, Alex, please let me have this. Just this one time.
Once per week, it can be commanded to create a hero's feast. Hero's Feast says, you bring forth a great feast, including magnificent table, chairs, service, food, and drink. Feast lasts 1 hour to consume, blah, blah, blah. So I'd say it's Nourishing simple fare, unless you use Hero's Feast, and then it's more
You're
fancy.
So bad. You are so mean.
Well, actually, I kind of like the flair of that, because it's like, you're going to do that before we're about to go into like a big battle or dungeon.
But also, simple nourishing fare can be just, you know, meat and tortillas and some cheese. That's simple and nourishing.
Yeah, well, does that work? Like, can I produce it like that?
Yeah, but ain't going to have no tomatoes or peppers in it.
Nah, see, it's not the same.
Well, what if I have a side salad dish? I feel like a side salad dish is pretty simple affair.
I think nourishing simple fare is meant to be like potatoes and bread, like
porridge,
rice, like not it's not it's pointedly not like
quality food.
A cuisine, yeah.
So no chicken fajitas is what I'm hearing.
You want to flavor it as like Yoli's Pond style, like that's fine. I'll give you like a cheese and chicken quesadilla, something like that. But like, it's not gonna pop, you know.
I'd be more than happy to introduce you to that food style when before we get ready to leave, we'll have a sending off party.
That's a good idea, Arginus. Plenty of salsa, please.
Well, I mean, in the meantime, I'm fine just having nourishing simple fare.
I mean, I was just talking about the stuff that Mirena packed for us before we left. I wasn't even talking about stuff from the cauldron.
She gave Uhtred an extra helping of salsa.
Yeah, do I want to share that salsa?
It's gonna be the last of your life.
Not the last of my life, but
you
could
never recreate that shit, dude.
It's like if you went to Mexico and you bought like authentic salsa and brought it back. It's like, do you really want to bust out the good salsa for people who like have never had salsa?
We can teleport into Marina's kitchen anytime we want.
You can.
That's true. I thought you thought more of Aluna than that, but I guess
I do. But there's like other people here. I don't want to have to share with everybody. You're thinking micro. I'm thinking macro. There's like eight heads in here.
You go to Luna. I'll give you the secret sauce later.
Well,
all right.
Food aside, Elena, that is least of the importance of what we've been up to.
Indeed. By now, the soldier has returned. He's got like a few loaves of semi-stale bread and like some like rice pudding. And a pail of water, and she just like digs in, like she doesn't like she, like you're all clearly welcome to partake as well, but like this is utilitarian eating time.
Oh, then in that case, I'm gonna absolutely still do the cauldron thing, like show it, like not waste food rations for these people.
All right. She goes, much appreciated, Arginus. And she sends the rice pudding back, but she keeps the bread because it's already going stale, so she doesn't eat it now. It's just gonna be hard as a rock tomorrow. Okay, so please, Uhtred and company, you have the floor.
I'm going to assume you heard from the Watcher Lord, what happened at Renchurch?
We have heard what happened at Renchurch. The Watcher Lord and his entourage, last we knew, they were still at large, but they have not returned yet.
Does 2 months sound right?
Well, you know that they were in
Hammer Rock.
Like deep. No, they were in Renchurch. Like they were deep in enemy territory when the Radiant Fire went off, and you have no idea what sort of conditions, what sort of enemy forces they had to contend with after you guys got teleported away. So they could have very well, like, Radiant Fire went off, they barely managed to evade it. And then, like, they picked themselves up, and oh god, it's an infinite undead okay. horde.
So, that we so 2 months to... isn't like a crazy. You sure they're still alive?
Yeah, I mean it's a military campaign, and they're deep in enemy territory, and like yeah, they it's certainly, you know, concerning. Like they're still out there, but it's not like oh well they're definitely right, right. gone. We've heard rumors of their flight from Renchurch. We believe they're heading straight to Absalom from up north, so we're not expecting them to come back here or anything, but...
No, I wouldn't expect them to come here, but it is good to know that they were able to make it outside of the range of the Radiant Fire.
And it's good to know, Uhtred, that you and your friends were singularly responsible for preventing them from charging into that. You all were heroes after the events of Vigil, but... Now, my men stay up at night exchanging fantasies of Uhtred and Randolph and Arginus joining them on the battlefield.
Thalias almost says something, but doesn't.
Corrects her. Randolph, Thalias.
Yeah, I definitely don't correct her, but when she says Randolph, I'm like, ooh.
You know that you're going to have to play the part of Thalias, right?
No, you're in too deep. You're Randolph now. So, it may go without saying, Uhtred, but you have the eternal gratitude of myself and everyone who remains in Lastwall for what you did at Renchurch.
Well, while I certainly appreciate it, we have more to do, or no one will be left around to even remember or appreciate what we have done.
Yes, of course, but... Doesn't mean we can't express our gratitude anyway.
No, but to that point, right before the Radiant Fire went off, Erasne managed in her last act to push the armies of Watcher Lord just outside of the Radiant Fire. And in that process, she sent us to a place called Zapatl.
What? Why would she do that?
Have you ever heard of the Kumaru Tree?
It sounds familiar, but I don't think so. Why don't you tell me anyway?
Well, centuries ago, during the formation of the Star Stone, there was a formation of what was known as the Kumaru Tree. And this was a great and powerful magical tree that grew in the nation of Zapatl. Erasne and Eridan spent much time in Zapatl and studied the Kumaru tree. Eridan even fashioned his shield from a piece of the Kumaru tree. And a piece of that shield, as you know, is now the shard lodged in the Whispering Tyrant's hand. During her time there, we met a woman who actually was able to tell us about the obols in around our hearts. And we came to learn that when each of us was caught in the Radiant Fire, and there are most likely more people like this currently out there, but when the Radiant Fire went off, little shards and pieces lodged themselves into our hearts and intertwined with our souls. Since I have returned from the Boneyard, those pieces have essentially been tuned to negative energy. Learning what they were, and while in Zapatl, this lady was able to kind of reverse them from a negative feel to a positive. We believe that if the Whispering Tyrant were to try and use the Radiant Fire on us again, it would actually rebound and ultimately damage the shard lodged in his hand. It would still come at the cost of our lives being in the radiant fire, but we do believe we can take away his super weapon.
Wow, Uhtred, that is some story. I would tell you to not throw your life away for this, but I'm sure you've already come to peace with that. That is interesting indeed.
I should also let you know that the Kumaru tree had been dead for about a century when we showed up. We were also able to provide them with a way to start a new Kumaru tree. You would be wise in the coming days and months to remember that Yoli's Pan and Zapatl are going to be growing in strength, and I hope our time there left the impression that they will give any support or aid that they are able to give.
Well, suppose we just need to live long enough to receive it then. I won't pretend that, assuming everything you said is true, Uhtred, and I'm not saying I disbelieve you, it's just that that's an incredible story, but...
I get it.
Assuming everything is true, you do indeed have an enormous weapon against Tar-Baphon. But even if you do have a means of sabotaging his radiant fire, I don't think he has reason to use it. At least not so long as his conventional army is an option. I'm not sure if using the radiant fire on Absalom, and I don't think anybody doubts that the reason he's at Absalom is to get his hands on the Starstone. But were he to use that radiant fire on the city itself, I personally have no way of knowing if the Starstone would survive that, and maybe Tar-Baphon knows the answer to that, maybe he doesn't. But considering he hasn't tried to use it yet, I'm assuming he either doesn't know the answer or he knows that it will destroy the Starstone. So as long as he has his conventional army to rely on, I don't think he's going to be tempted to use it.
Well, I would prefer us not provoking him to use it on Absalom, but rather provoking him to use it just on us.
Yes, and at any rate, it is his style to stand behind his army and let his minions do his bidding for him. So let's confirm that Hammerrock isn't providing him with an edge that we can deny him before we go directly to him and try to provoke him when that might not be an option right now anyway.
Yeah, I too think it is curious that he would feel the need to even be concerned with Hammerrock and a bunch of refugees. There was no one that you knew of note?
Well, as I said, I already sent several agents there to look into it, but we lost contact with them.
Right, and that was after the Radiant Fire went off, so...
Yes.
I'm sure we can go and take a peek around.
Alright, well, as long as you're going, you should know that Hammerrock, it's a castle in the Sandcarver Hills, which gives it a good view of the surrounding terrain. Back when Lastwall was still a fairly young nation, surveyors found some incomplete dwarven ruins there and used those as the foundation for the castle. Those ruins had some hammer-shaped sigils, which is how the site got its name. The castle has a reputation for being haunted.
It certainly does now.
Yes. Leaders thought this was only from the undiscovered tunnels below, settling after so many years, but yes, with the Whispering Tyrant's interest in that place, I would say the rumors may have been true. Also, Hammerrock is designed for last stands, to buy time. The commander can activate several potent wards meant to kill anyone attempting to breach the keep. We don't know if they're active. Two of my agents, Yanthrus and Quenlin, seemed confident that they could suppress the wards if they'd been activated, So find the team and coordinate with them if you can.
How long have you been without contact?
It's been almost a week. The team was four of my best troubleshooters. Yanthras is an elf sorcerer from Kionin and an expert at transportation magic. He officially led the team. Quenlan Gavix is a veteran halfling scout. Bert is a half-orc who spent over a decade under deep cover in Belkson. She's a cleric of Kalinahat, Angel of Espionage. Garmel Fallon is a strange one, a Nidalese man who escaped his homeland. He found some comfort in the Avenger Regathiel's grace and is one of the most cunning paladins I've ever met. That is all four of them. To reach Hammer Rock, I actually have an abjurer on retainer who can take you there. And actually, I believe he'll be very pleased to see you. Quickly, come with me.
Elias follows, along with Randolph.
Valbar follows, but is a little confused why we don't just teleport there with Archinus.
No, she has someone who's good at teleporting.
So Eluna takes you guys back outside of this repurposed shop that you've been in. She walks you down the street, and where the street should end, and there would be like an intersection. Instead, there seems to be like an extra building, just kind of placed, like semi into the intersection, and you guys would recognize it as a secure shelter spell.
Nice,
oh, nifty.
And Eluna walks right up to the door. She knocks on it, and after a few seconds, the door opens, and you guys see Dondon Derridan.
Dondon.
And
Dondon.
I never met him, but
never thought I'd see your face again.
He walks out, and he just kind of gets a look at you all. He's, hey, guys, how have you been?
I was imagining his first response would be like, oh, fuck, what are you guys doing back here?
Uhtred's a little impressed to see him here.
I heard rumors that that you guys have been out fighting the good fight. I've got a pretty good gig set up here with Eluna. He kind of like puffs his chest out, and you can see he's got this like very official looking pendant pinned to his cloak, and he wags a finger at Uhtred. He says, "And that's Knight Arcanist Derridan to you, or Sir Dondon, if you like."
Well, Sir Dondon, it sure looks good on you.
Thank you, thank you. Well, after everything in Vigil, well...
You don't even need to explain, Dondon. I'm just glad to see that you seem to be making a positive difference around here.
Good. I don't like explaining it, but I'm glad that you get it. I have a feeling that with Eluna bringing you guys here, my cushy gig is about to get a little spiky.
Well, it's definitely going to have a lot more death on the table.
Death is always on the table.
Oh, this is Valbar, by the way, Dondon. Dondon, Valbar, Dondon, Dondon, Valbar.
Nice to meet you, Valbar.
Valbar just silently kind of nods his head at him as this stare takes hold.
How does anyone have a real conversation with you when you're hitting everybody with stares?
Well, you're just flavoring it that way, right? Because I think as written, they don't even know that you're affecting them.
It's written that you can choose to erase the memory of the stare.
Gotcha.
Oh, well, I just kind of flavor it like, yeah, like technically they don't necessarily know, but the because part of my effect is like making you clumsy, I imagine it just kind of like fucks with your equilibrium for a second.
Yeah.
Eluna says, yes, well, Dondon was going to be teleporting to Hammer Rock tomorrow morning anyway to see what he could glean from the situation, but with you all here, I figure if he's going anyway, it might save you some magic going with him, and Once there, Dondon is to scout the area away from Hammer Rock. Don like nods his head profusely and says, "Yeah, I'm not going anywhere near that place."
Oh, come on, Dondon. Just be like old times.
Yeah, no, I didn't like those times, Uhtred. They turned me into a good guy. that's just how traumatic they were.
That's a fair point.
Well, Hammer Rock can't be any worse than the last time I was there.
Oh my god.
Well,
that's really dark.
Maybe it is, maybe it's not. What do you all know about witch gates? And we'll see.
Fuck them.
Sigh.
On the Inspired Incompetence podcast.
Okay.
See ya.
See ya.
See ya.